Smart Talk. We want to welcome all of you, no matter how you're listening to us live on the radio or on our podcast. This is Smart Talk with Robin and Al. I'm Al. I'm the host this week. Robin and I go back and forth between hosting the show, so sometimes you'll hear Robin hosting it, and sometimes I'll be hosting it. But Robin's right here, right across the table for me. Hello, Robin.
Hi, Al. Thanks for letting me come in today.
Well, we both decided that only being on twice a month and letting the other one go on their own just wasn't enough time for us to get together and talk about the issues of the day. So we decided we would both be on it. Our topic today is poverty in Tucson. Let me give you a couple of facts just to get us started. One out of four adults living in the city of Tucson fall below the poverty line. And one of three children grow up in households below the poverty line. And where did I get that information from? I got it from Professor Brian Mayer of the Sociology Department at the University of Arizona. Brian has been studying poverty in Tucson and in the United States for a while now, and he runs an absolutely fascinating course where he takes the undergraduates out and gives some questionnaires to people in town in terms of their level of well-being and how they do with poverty or not with poverty. So before we go any further, let me turn it over to Brian. And first, welcome, Brian.
Hi, Al. Good morning.
It's good to see you. I see you running around the halls at the U, but it's nice to have you right across from us here at the here at KVOI. If you want to call in, please do. It's getting a signal from John about moving my mic. Oh, Brian, you got to move closer to your mic. That's it. Okay. So why don't you start us off and tell us about how you got interested in the poverty progress and give us some facts about Tucson, Arizona, and the state of poverty today.
Great. Thanks, Al. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk a little bit about this project. The University of Arizona was invited by Mayor Jonathan Rothschild in 2012, who had just formed Mayor's Poverty Commission. In 2010, the census data revealed that Tucson was considered to be the sixth poorest city of our size, so about 500,000 people, and that put us on a rather unfortunate list with other cities really struggling at the height of the Great Recession to deal with declining economies, increasing rents, higher rates of evictions, and Tucson, unfortunately, peaked at about 25-26% of the people living there falling below the federal poverty threshold. So Mayor Rothschild wanted to bring together all of the really amazing nonprofits that we have in town together with the various city and county agencies to make sense of those rates and what we could do better. And so one of the things that the Poverty Commission wanted to do was to better understand what poverty in Tucson looked like. One of the challenges, and this happens with any research on poverty, even when done by the federal government, is that we use these federal poverty thresholds. So, for example, today, for a family of four, that federal poverty threshold is about $24,000. But, of course, that number applies equally to a household in the city of New York or the city of San Francisco as it does to a household in the city of Tucson.
Let me just jump in for a quick second here. When you say a poverty threshold, $24,000, how do they determine that?
That's a great story, Al. And so for those of us that sort of follow the history of studying poverty, we trace this back to an economist named Molly Olshansky, who in the 1960s, as part of the War on Poverty, was asked to quantify what it meant to be poor in the United States. And so her idea, and what we still do today, is sort of what we call the food basket principle. And that is that a household should spend about a third of their annual income on food. And so if we look, at least in the 1960s, as what it would cost to feed a family of four, multiply that times three, we come up with the federal poverty threshold. And that scales up based on the number of adults and children in the house.
And so feeding a family of three or comes to about the $24,000 that you talked about.
Right. But one of the challenges is, in terms of the cost of living, is it the same in terms of the 1960s as it is today? Is it really just about food, rent, and other necessities?
If you were to adjust the poverty line to make it reflect realities today, what would you do?
Sure. There are ways that we can get at that. There are measures that we can call supplemental poverty measures that take into account things like digital subscriptions, cell phones, various types of bills that we didn't have to think about in the 1960s that sort of are what the cost of living is today. So, for example, if you want to find a job, if you want to know what time the bus is coming, you really have to get on the internet. So do you need a mobile device with a current subscription? Do you need a home PC or a tablet? How are you going to access information that's necessary for life today?
I can just hear someone out there saying, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Did I just hear you say that to get state money from my earnings to give in a poverty program, that we now need to factor in that everyone needs a cell phone, or everyone needs to be on social media, or everyone needs to be checking their Instagram or seeing what the Kardashians are up to, or getting sports scores? Is that part of what it means to not be in poverty?
Well, is a, to cell have a cell phone is less than a landline at this point. So it would make sense to have a cell phone. It's cheaper.
But can you
explain the Poverty Project? Poverty Project.
Sure. Well, just
takes him off the cell phone point, but that's fine. Go ahead, answer what the Poverty Project is.
Certainly, I don't think any policy welfare advocate is advocating more time spent on social media.
I know, I was baiting you, but I was raising the question. I'm just guessing what folks out there might be thinking. What could we eventually include in You Need Today to Live By that people might wonder?
I want to take the bait. So, for example, in the course that Robin has asked about in terms of the Poverty Project, one of the things that I ask my undergraduates to do is to see if they qualify for SNAP benefits, food assistance. It's done online now.
Help us. SNAP means?
A Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Thank you.
And so this is what you fill out to get, we used to call them food stamps. And you get a debit card, and you can take this to the grocery store or other places and use that money to spend on food. That form is done online. You can do it in person, but the majority of people that apply for it is done online, and it's a complicated website. It's not easy to do. So do you need something that can access that website? Yeah, it might be very difficult for you to get to a welfare office, depending on where you lived and buses and things like that. So it's not that it's all about sort of being online or having a digital presence. It's being able to access the necessities in life
so
that are
digital,
part of modern
the digital
today.
Divide then really is another way that it interacts with poverty, that less money to be online. It becomes circular and leading, you know, ever further into poverty and whatnot. So as Robin said, tell us about the poverty course.
Sure. And I think in terms of, we belong to a school of sociology where we teach a lot of courses related to social life and social interactions. And one of those fundamentals are the people that unfortunately are experiencing poverty. And even at the height of the Great Recession, data suggested that one out of every two individuals would spend some point in their life experiencing poverty. And so it's a very important topic for us to encourage our students to think about. But the questions that you're asking in terms of, well, what types of food should they be able to access with their SNAP card? Should they be able to access social media with what we used to call an Obama phone, where people could get free access to a cell phone? Those are tough questions. And this is something that we used to do in terms of teaching kids in a lecture hall, right? We would teach 300 students about poverty in America. We'd have them watch movies. We'd have them read books and try and get them to think about what that experience was like. But then comes the Mayor's Poverty Commission, formed back in 2012. And so 2013, they came to us and said, we really need to gather data that shows what the cost of living is in Tucson and the struggles that people living below the poverty threshold might have. Can you help us? And we said, well, certainly, you know, a lot of us have ongoing research careers where this might not be a good fit. But one thing that all of us do is talk about poverty to some degree in our courses. This is a central element of what we're trying to get our undergraduates to think about. How can we bring those two goals together? So the idea was, how do we combine a course on poverty with the goal of collecting data that would be beneficial to the city, the county, and the nonprofits?
Gotcha. So let me, you just raised a question in my mind. It's cheaper to live in Tucson than probably other cities. And there are probably some that are cheaper than Tucson, but it's cheaper. So falling below the poverty level, you may not be as bad off as you would be in other cities where it costs more.
Correct.
So there's a slight adjustment, perhaps, that you need to make. It's like when people are hired into Tucson, they'll get offers below someone else, and they'll say, well, you pay this guy in Chicago, why aren't you paying me? And they'll say, well, you know, it's cheaper to live in Tucson, and or it's so warm, you don't need as much clothes. And there's all kinds of reasons. We see that at the U all the time, and that we have to do that. So exactly what do the kids do out there in this class?
Right. So the kids conduct what we call the Tucson...
Students, pardon me. No, I say kids, students.
Yes, they keep getting younger, right? We stay the same age.
Absolutely.
The students are challenged to go out and complete surveys on behalf of the Tucson Poverty Project. And so usually each semester we enroll about 60 students.
What are the questions?
The questions really sort of focus on what you were just talking about. Are you able to get by on a low level of income? And so we screen households. We do this randomly in some of the most vulnerable census tracts or neighborhoods spread out across Tucson. We're up on the north side, south side, east side, around campus, for example. And there we knock on doors and we say, what's your income? And if you're making less than double the federal poverty threshold, so we would call that near poverty, we ask you a series of questions. Most of them focus on what are you earning, what are you spending, and are you able to get by? So, for example, we can calculate whether or not you technically fall below the federal poverty threshold, but we can also ask, are you putting money away every month? Are you just getting by, or are you losing money? Are you going into debt? And it turns out that the federal poverty threshold is not a perfect association with that ability to just get by. In fact, a lot of people that are close to that federal poverty threshold say that they are getting by. They're not putting money away. They're still quite vulnerable, but they're not losing money right out.
Yeah. John, we're going to take a break here, and please stay with us, because when we get back, we're going to ask Brian exactly what people say and what they think they need more money for. So stay with us. Remember, you can also call in 790-2040. We got a caller on the line, so we are going to go back to Brian after we take Layla's call, and he's going to tell us exactly what people in Tucson say when they ask him about can they get by on the money they have. Layla, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Hi, Layla.
Hi, Robin. I have a question for your guest about the Pima County Preschool Investment Program and if they are familiar with that and the effect of affordable child care on intergenerational poverty.
Sure, that's a great question. And you'll forgive me if I'm not immediately familiar with the name, but this is sort of the revised version of Strong Start Tucson.
Yes, yes. Yeah. We're taking it countywide, and we are approaching the Board of Supervisors, I believe it's May 14th, and asking them to begin with a pilot program. Mr. Huckleberry has put aside $5 million to just begin the project, and so we're hoping that they pass it, our Board of Supervisors passes it, and we can begin on seeing that great change in our county.
I think that's great, and certainly I wish you luck. I work with a number of groups that are trying to get behind this. One thing that happened was the Poverty Commission ended and then was reformed and now is operating under the title of the Southern Arizona Prosperity Alliance. And so I'm continuing to advise that group and share data with them. And that's going to be the number one thing that they're going to work on promoting. And so hopefully they're able to do so. Because when we ask families if they're able to get by, one of the things that they're spending a tremendous amount of money on is childcare, especially early childcare. And so this is a major issue for the county and the city to take on.
So let me jump in here for a second, Layla, and I got a question for Brian. When the students go out and ask folks about what they can afford and can't afford, what's the number one thing that people say they have trouble covering with their present income?
Housing. Rent.
Paying
in particular.
Rent. Yes. And number two?
Number two would probably be childcare.
Childcare. Number three?
Number three probably comes down to transportation, being able to afford a car and maintenance on the car.
A few years ago, the Southern Arizona Women's Foundation did a study on women in poverty. And one of the things they showed is that women have these incomes, but when they have kids under the age of five, the cost of childcare is so high that it often puts them in poverty for those years. And they have to struggle the whole time their kids are in childcare to be able to keep a job. Layla, is there a priority for low-income families with the childcare?
I think a reversion of Strong Start Tucson and the Pima County Child preschool investment is that we took the community's feedback and it being prioritized at a zero, level zero, so that there is no copayment for women under 200 or families 200% of the federal poverty level and below, because we see if they're at the 200% federal poverty level or below that, that it, the child care is a huge part of their income, and so they have taken that into as a priority this time around.
Okay. Let me ask the whole group here, Layla, you too. It seems that most industrial countries do have child care policies. What is it about the United States that's made it so reluctant to follow others?
Brian looks like he has an answer.
Layla was jumping off. Let's give it to our guest.
I think it's part of the overall picture of individualism versus collectivism, where we care if that, you know, old pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of mentality. And especially when we're talking about children, we can't expect people. I think it was Dr. Martin Luther King who said that it is a cruel joke to require people in poverty to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they have no bootstraps to pull or to pull no themselves shoes. Up by.
That's a great line. Grab your ankles and
totally
pull on those.
Yeah. Yeah. And so whether it's about children or families in poverty, we really need to, I think, do better culturally and helping each other out.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Oh, I'm a perpetual optimist.
So is there anything immediately you feel good that we're going to pass legislatively or in the city or the state?
I'm really hoping that we pass this preschool investment program in our county and the board of supervisors sees the wisdom in this program. So right, I'm optimistic.
Okay, we'll join you in that wish. Layla, thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. So, Brian, you hit a few of the things that they folks have trouble with. What was the most surprising thing talking to them about anything that came up or that the students didn't really know and was an eye-opening for you that students don't know people actually struggle with some of these things?
That's a great question, Al.
Too many questions at once. I know. Pick any of them or...
Well, no, I think I have two answers, one that surprises me and one that surprises the students. For the students, one of the questions that we asked to try and get at this, are you able to get by, is if you had to come up with an emergency supplement of money, how would you do so? And we used to ask this question in terms of if you had to come up with $1,000 in a month, let's say your car experienced some mechanical issues, you had a medical bill, a dental bill, you had something come up that you unexpected, how would you pay that $1,000? The number one answer, I couldn't. And this really surprised the students, the idea that these people that they were talking to couldn't just call their parents, their family, their brothers, their sisters, and borrow $1,000 was shocking to them.
Wow.
And so we actually lowered the number for that question down to $500 a month to see if we could get people to think about, you know, would they sell plasma? Would they sell things to a pawn shop? Would they find a secondary job? And we still find that people just can't respond to that question. And so that tells me when we think about this idea of getting by, that people will say, yes, I'm not losing money on a month-to-month basis, but they're not building a reserve. They're not able to sort of move forward or advance in their socioeconomic status because they're not banking their money.
Gotcha. You know, we were talking earlier about poverty, and you had mentioned that after the Great Recession, I guess that's in 2008, Phoenix was moving ahead, replacing lost jobs, people getting back to work, making more money, and that Tucson lagged behind them. So talk to us a little about what you think the difference is between why Phoenix was able to take off faster than us.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting in the data, even if we start looking nationally and then look at the state and what's going on within the state, is that a lot of places are doing better after the Great Recession. Nationally, the poverty rate went up, but it's come back down. Tucson went up to about that 25%, that 1 in 4 rate, but it hasn't come back down. Phoenix has. So what's going on? To me, it centers around that question of housing and rent affordability, which is linked to things like new construction and jobs that come along with construction. And a lot of those things we don't see here in Tucson. We see a very tight housing market where there's not a lot of new units being added. And when they are, they're just luxury units. So people are constantly struggling to find affordable housing. At the same time, we're not seeing an influx of a lot of good paying jobs.
So let's step behind that if we can. What is it about Tucson as opposed to Phoenix? Geography, other businesses, or a perennial that comes up on AM talk radio shows, a friendly business climate that Phoenix might have that Tucson doesn't have that keeps us from having more of these construction jobs? You would imagine folks from back east or up north or Canada who want something warm and dry would just as much come to Tucson as they would come to Phoenix. Why are we slower?
That's the challenging question. And for so many years, Phoenix has been one of the fastest growing cities in the United States. And people are moving there from places like California, pulling their money out of the more high tax states, the expensive states, and moving it to Phoenix. And they're sort of coming in and they're bringing that wealth. There are higher paying jobs. So for example, Robin was asking this question. Jobs almost universally pay 10 to 20% more in Phoenix than they do in Tucson. Is that because, like Al was saying, employers are like, well, it's cheap to live here in Tucson, so we're not going to pay you as much. But everything from high paying lawyers get paid less in Tucson than they do in Phoenix. And the same goes for most service jobs. So what is driving that? That's a big question. I think it has to do with growth and whether or not that's due to a lack of a pro-business environment. I don't really see a strong creative class here. You know, one of the things that I worry about...
Creative class, help me.
Creative class. So let's say young entrepreneurs, professionals, folks that were training at the University of Arizona that are getting their four-year degree, which Tucson doesn't do great with overall. We don't have a lot of college-educated professionals, although we have the University of Arizona. And that's because many of them that are doing this locally have to go elsewhere to earn a high-paying job. So they've done the hard work of the degree. And if they want to get a return on that investment, they have to go elsewhere, Phoenix, out of state.
And we probably have a fair share of out-of-state students because of Arizona. Is a, not sad to say the U of A, but a fun place and a nice place to go to college. Let's leave it like that. But then want to either return home or, like you say, we all know folks or have had kids ourselves who, when they grow up, you know, want to go to the big city or want to try something else and don't stay in the Tucson area.
You know, it's interesting that you say that we don't have a creative class here, because when you look at the arts, most of the arts groups actually start in Tucson. Arizona Theater, Arizona Opera, Arizona Ballet. A lot of them transfer to Phoenix after they've been established as a statewide theater company or opera company because of the finances in Phoenix. But the arts groups actually start here.
Well, perhaps I was misusing the term creative. I mean, to me,
or maybe
I was,
I'm misunderstanding the word creative.
Well, we're just being creative with the use creative. I'm thinking about sort of the young entrepreneurs, you know, whether or not it's social entrepreneurship, you know, funding or founding a new nonprofit, or someone that has the next big digital startup idea. I don't know that I see a lot of them grounded in Tucson. Of course, you know, flocking to Silicon Valley is sort of a rite of passage for a lot of these people. But I think even those that don't make that sojourn are still going to Phoenix instead of staying here and trying in.
It's a great question because the U of A really works hard at that. I know Eller has a number of startup things. There's Tech Launch Arizona. If you come up with something that will really help you commercialize it, there's all kinds of hackathons where, you know, students get to show their computer skills, and I know we're trying really hard to do it, and I know the new administration under President Robbins also would like to see us accelerate in that area.
I just want to ask a quick question, and that is, what's the impact of high poverty rates on the community as a whole?
That's a great question, too. And Layla, our caller, was talking about these initiatives at the county level. And one of the things that's really impressed me is the county's take on the economic impact of poverty. So one of the things that we have going on in Pima County that other counties don't is that we have a chapter in our economic development plan that's dedicated solely to poverty. And the county has been very interested in what quantifying the expenses of people living in poverty, people not being able to be in stable jobs, people not being able to promote within those jobs and earn a higher income. And those types of things are what we would see drive down our poverty rates. And Pima County recognizes that's an issue. So they have a number of coordinated efforts to try and promote promotion within jobs, job retention, job entry, to try and help people move through that. I don't know that I can give us an exact number, but I know Pima County has been working towards that, because sometimes that helps drive the needle or helps drive people become motivated to get involved.
We're going to take a break now, and but stick with us, because when we come back, I'm going to ask both Robin and Brian what they think about proposals for a guaranteed income. That is, you get X amount of dollars no matter what you do to get started. Stay with us. All right, Smart Talk with Al and Robin. We're back on the air, and as promised, I'm going to throw out the $64,000 question, which is, should we adopt a guaranteed income? That is, if we do have problems of poverty, poor always with us, some people say, doesn't seem to go away. We had a war on poverty years ago. It's back up with us now. If there was a guaranteed annual salary that you got right off the top, would that help cure this? Is that just a boondoggle, or is that really a future with jobs being robotized or going overseas that we need to do it? I'll throw it out to you guys to give me a yes or a no.
Well, let's start with no. Let's say, what's going on in Tucson, and what makes Tucson unique in terms of poverty? And one of those things, and it's not just a single thing, but a part of it is the number of people that we have living here on a fixed income. We have a lot of retirees that come to Tucson because it's an affordable place to live, it has a nice climate, and they are on, call it, a universal basic income. But we still don't see growth in Tucson the way we do other places. So the idea of universal basic income being universal means that it's not means tested, it's not targeted. And I think it sort of represents an underinvestment in the potential that Tucson has.
I'm not an expert, but I did read an article about Finland.
That will do.
And one of the things they found is, now they did this, they gave universal basic incomes to 5,000 people. All of these 5,000 people were out of work, and they gave them this amount of money that was above what they were getting with public assistance. And what they found is that the same percentage of people went out and were still looking for jobs, went out and still got jobs. And there were people that didn't, for one reason or another. Some of them were had other issues, addiction, mental illness, other things. But I have to say, I'm in favor of it. And it's not just because I'm reaching retirement age.
Because
I think, okay, this is going to sound so hokey, but I think in the richest nation in the world, we should not have people who are struggling to get food, whose kids, I was just talking to someone last week, and he told me that someone had come to him, and this was a teacher, and it was why he was supporting food. This is the pastor, a guy who heads Pastors for Kids in Texas. And he said this teacher came and told him that she had a kid who came and she was late, so she didn't get the free breakfast. And the kid just started crying and crying. And the teacher goes, "What's the problem?" And he goes, "Well, last night was my night to skip dinner. You know, all the kids take a turn. Last night was my night, which means I haven't had anything since lunch yesterday."
Wow.
That this is happening in the United States is insane.
Now, there's an old line that what separates civilization from barbarism is six meals. And it took
I love that.
I thought about it. Okay, so three is breakfast, lunch, dinner. It's day one. Second three, lunch, breakfast, lunch, dinner. It's day two. 2 days without eating, and I'm thinking about snitching a candy bar. I'm thinking about stealing something. And so it really shows you what a thin line it is. Six meals separates civilization from barbarism. It's a lot thinner than you do. The other thing is, I think this conversation about the guaranteed income is probably thinking much about the future, which I hinted at, namely, if we do get more robotization and the problems that Robin mentioned, it may very well turn out. The problem with the universal income, of course, is that it isn't just for people in poverty. It's for everyone, or it's not universal like universal healthcare. But it is things like the Green New Deal that is being put on the table to think about. And one nice thing just politically is it's good to see the Democrats come up with some new and different ideas rather than traditional things, where for the last few years, the Republicans, like it or not, have come up with all kinds of new plans to do this and do that, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a interesting time of idea birth, the turbulence of America not working, the parties locked in some kind of strange thing where for the last quarter of a century, everyone's tribalized up and just speaks to their own silos. But out of that, not getting anywhere, is coming new kinds of ideas. It'll be interesting to see, particularly with the primaries coming up for the Democrats, which of these gain traction, which of these polls say Americans are interested in, which of these get put down by the opposition or by other candidates within the field itself. Brian, let's turn back to you. I know we've talked about giving and the importance of charity. Could you talk some about the gaps between charitable giving now and some unmet needs here in Tucson?
Yeah, so you asked earlier the question of what surprised me from doing this survey from 5 years, and this led to this question of gaps. And that's when we asked residents, are you getting the help that you need? Are you getting forms of state-based aid? So, for example, SNAP food stamps that we talked about, access, healthcare. And are you getting help from charitable organizations, food banks, diaper banks, clothing banks, churches, so on and so forth? And we were stunned by the number of people that had some object needs, right? We sort of could identify that they were cutting meals. They didn't have winter clothes for their kids to go to school in the 1 month of winter that we have here. 96% of the poorest people that we talked to said they had never received help from a nonprofit organization. And that just surprised me because we think of Tucson as being this really amazing charitable place. And so that led to the question of, if we do have a rather robust, healthy nonprofit community, and at the same time we have people not getting what they need, what does that gap look like?
And
the trouble is that a lot of our charitable giving goes to a single cause, and that is education, and in particular, early childhood education. And that's, of course, a very important need, and it leads to a lot of good outcomes. Hopefully, high school retention rates go up, employment rates go up, but all those other needs that are out there, particularly housing, are not being met.
Robin, I'm going to stick this right to you. You're getting ready to talk, but you, Voices for Education, as many of you may or may not know, Robin is a longtime activist, founded this public service agency, not agency, but startup, or what do you want to call it?
And startup, creative startup.
Yeah, and Brian's talking to the brothers and sisters on education side about sharing some of the money to contribute to other kinds of things. What do you think of that? Brian didn't say that. I did, but I'm saying that.
Thanks, Al.
As someone who worked in education advocacy, this is shocking to me because I think of who actually gets the money is really worthy causes like the Humane Society and cat centers that, you know, so animals don't have to be put down. So it's very interesting. I wonder if that's because of the tax credits, that people get a tax credit. But I wanted to go back to something you said with people not asking for services. And what I've heard, I don't know if this is true, so I'd like your take on it, is that most people think they're a grade up from where they actually are. So one of the things I've heard is that a lot of the giving in our community and across the United States comes from low-income people, that they are actually percentage-wise a bigger donator, giver, whether it's to their church or to a shelter, give a bigger percentage than wealthy.
Yeah, you know, I don't have access to those numbers. So when I think about where the nonprofit community is, we did this survey of nonprofits where we looked at the total number of organizations as opposed to the giving. We did sort of look at what their financial records were, and it's pretty even. And so I might disagree that all of the money or the majority of the money goes to sort of humane or sort of pro-pet societies and organizations and things like that. But it definitely seemed by far that if we just counted the number of nonprofits organized and registered in the city of Tucson, they were focused on education.
People often say that we have too many nonprofits in Tucson and that what we need is consolidation to be more effective. Folks, thoughts?
No, I mean, certainly it's something that I hear from some of the larger funders is that rather than give to a single early childhood literacy organization that's going to be neighborhood focused, they'd rather see something that was region or citywide. And we've seen a number of groups be successful like that. For example, Literacy Connects is doing really amazing work, I would say, countywide. And I think they were an amalgamation of a number of smaller organizations that realized they all had their own operating costs. They all had their own directors and all of the expenses that goes along with maintaining that. And so the best way to serve the city or the region's needs was to come together.
Go ahead.
I think that's a good idea. But especially in the field I work in, the giving community really can't fix education, and I'm talking K through 12. So we have, you know, millionaires and billionaires, the Gates, the Eli Broad, all these people who are directing education policy and giving money, but they can never really do what a state and what the federal government should be doing. And so I think we should be pushing more in that area of infrastructure from our government rather than asking for people to supplement education out of their pockets.
Sure.
You know, we switched for a second here to talk about groups that give money and about the government and whatnot. Brian, I want to turn back to you and ask you about what you hear from actual people in low-income neighborhoods about how they're coping with limited opportunities. Maybe there's a story or two or some patterns that have shown up, but we've been pretty general, excuse me, talking dollars and cents. What feelings and sentiments have you gotten from folks when you talk to them?
We've heard some pretty powerful stories. I'm trying to think of some of them that were more recent. Right now, we have a follow-up class to the Poverty Project where students are working in the Amphi neighborhood on the north side, which 45% of the households there are below the poverty threshold. 45. So that's close to 1 in 2. That's amazing. But of course, it's functioning, right? People are getting by. And there, that's where the story of some educators that we talked to there said attendance at the schools really goes down during the cold days because those families simply can't afford to buy a jacket. It's, of course, warm most of the time in Tucson, so their kids are in pants and a t-shirt, and to get that coat is just too much. And that was really painful for me to hear. And you can imagine in colder climates, there's much better clothing closets or giving that says, hey, collect your winter coats and let's distribute them. We don't think about that in Tucson, at least I don't.
Did you find some interesting adaptive mechanisms of communities working together, sharing, bringing relatives into it? That is, if the state doesn't provide and the welfare agencies don't provide and other groups don't provide, you turn to uncles and aunts and brothers and sisters and things like that?
Well, I think the neighborhoods that are better able to do that are more successful. So, for example, we could think about sort of cultural differences and family dynamics. So 46% of Tucson considers themselves ethnically to be Hispanic, and we associate that with larger families, more adherence to the Catholic Church, and there tends to be more giving within those families, extended families in particular. And so we see neighborhoods like the Sunnyside neighborhood claim that they're able to solve lots of more local problems than neighborhoods like the Amphi, where you have a lot of refugees, you have a lot of single parents that are living there for just a couple years. So there's not that social cohesion that produces collective efficacy, the ability to get done in a lot of these poorer neighborhoods.
Reminds me of David Brooks, the New York Times columnist who was a conservative, I suppose he still is, but shadows of doubt cross his soul occasionally. He writes these wonderful op-eds in the New York Times, and he's sort of the sociologist Times writer in a way, and he talks about the fabric of social life being very important for things like poverty and how we need to rebuild and keep it together, and too much atomism or loneliness increases the poverty and not being able to reach out and do things. We're going to take a break here. Stick with us. And Robin's just dying to say something, and she'll do it then. And then we'll close up by talking about what you folks can do out there, who possibly to contact, and find out more about poverty in Tucson. All right, we're back. It is Smart Talk, and our guest is Professor Brian Mayer of the School of Sociology at the University of Arizona. We're talking today about poverty in Tucson, 790-2040, if you want to call in and ask Professor Mayer a question. Robin's got a question she wants to ask.
So I've been thinking about this while we've been talking, Brian, and that is that since poverty is the greatest predictor of academic success, and it means that you have more kids failing the third grade holdback when reading tests, which is a very punitive exam we give here and very unfair, especially to low-income students. If we improved, I know you don't want to put all the money into education, but if we improved education...
Pushing that cookie, aren't you? That's fine.
We're supposedly taking it all right now. But if that improves, if we take care of poverty, which would help our education system, wouldn't that actually bring in more jobs? Wouldn't we? Are we getting fewer jobs in Phoenix because we have more poverty and then less success in our academic education attainment?
I would agree. I mean, certainly we could debate it as a chicken and an egg question in terms of what comes first, the folks that can take the high-paying jobs versus the high-paying jobs. But I agree. I mean, I think if I was an outside employer, and I'm very grateful for Caterpillar and the other folks that have decided to locate here, but if I were to come and drive around Tucson or look at these data, I'd have doubts whether or not I could man my workforce. Of course, I'm going to get in trouble with some of my friends here working for the city and the county. But I do think it's something that we need to address. We need to be able to demonstrate if you want to come here and build a company to have a successful entrepreneurship program, we need to have the folks that you can employ. Absolutely.
You know, we talked a little before we went on air, and I asked Robin and Brian what sorts of topics they'd like to talk about. And something that came up that I wasn't aware of, which is why we have these experts on the show, was House Bill 25. Boy, I'm sorry for this voice. House Bill 2523. You guys want to talk about why that's important and how that's tied to poverty?
A couple years ago, the citizens of Arizona put on a ballot measure that said we're going to raise the minimum wage law in Arizona and the amounts. And a legislator, Travis Grantham, presented this bill. It's 2523, which creates a special class, and that is a class of people, of workers who are under the age of 22. And he wants to keep that, allow businesses to pay a lower wage to those people who are in school, under 22, that kind of thing. This is, I think, a very dangerous thing to do, and I'd like to have your opinion about if you think it's a good idea.
No, I mean, I think it's a terrible idea, and it gets to sort of this more cultural question of poverty in terms of who deserves our assistance, who deserves the state's assistance. And so the minimum wage is designed to help stabilize low-income earners, in particular families, so they're able to get by. But I'll point out that a single minimum wage earner at $11 an hour is only going to bring home maybe $20,000 a year. And so if you're supporting a family on your own on that, you're still going to be below the federal poverty threshold. And of course, these are a lot of young people that could be going on to get their degree at the same time mm-hmm. as they're trying to hold down one or more of these jobs. So this is a highly vulnerable population that we want to be successful, and to create a special class for them so we're able to pay them less would just seem to drive us further down the poverty hole. And I think it's an awful idea.
And one of the things is students. That is one of the goals with this. Although it seems that I have to agree with you that these are kids or young people who are in school working their hardest. They might, you know, you were talking about families when you said, you know, if you had to borrow $500, where would you go? And they have no place to go. And these are the students, these are the young people who would be affected by this, is people who have no place to go. They're supporting themselves, trying to get through school and all this stuff. And it just seems very punitive.
Right. And the question is, where are we going with that? I mean, if we pass this bill, what does it mean for our investment in tomorrow in terms of these people that we want to help move into stable, high-paying jobs? It seems like we're creating a hole for them that then they'll have to climb out of to improve their earnings.
You know, something tied to this is what do we actually do, and the idea of job retraining. And it's been pointed out that the unemployed coal workers, the struggle coal workers, coal miners in Appalachia, West Virginia, et cetera, that, you know, they're at age 55 or something, not interested in learning how to code so that they can move to Silicon Valley. So, Brian, when you think about practical things, about there's one thing to say bring more jobs, but say some of the jobs are Silicon Valley type jobs. Do we still believe in job training, or is that less relevant, or just a waste of money? Or let me try it another way. What's been the best proven way to eliminate poverty? Just give them the money, train folks. What?
Well, let's start with there's no silver bullet. But if we look in terms of policies comparatively and say what's worked the best
yes.
to alleviate American poverty, by far, hands down, it's the earned income tax credit. So it's not exactly...
Explain exactly what that is, because even I don't know what that is.
So that's not exactly a universal basic income, but it is if you are earning below a certain threshold, and oftentimes that's above the federal poverty threshold, and you're paying your taxes, you get some of that money back. So it lowers your income tax rate, the level that which you're at. And usually, I think on average, it puts about $1,500 to $2,000 in the hands of working low-income families. And being able to reinvest that money, whether or not it's in terms of rent, having a bank account to deal with emergencies, more food on the table, by far, policy scholars...
A winter coat.
A winter coat for those couple of days here in Tucson. By far, policy scholars see that as the single most powerful investment we've made in alleviating poverty.
So let's, as we're starting to wind down here a little, not folks that you should change the channel. We still got important stuff to talk about. But let's do a little summary things here. So can we think about the top two things that we need to know, Brian and Robin too, about poverty in Tucson? What don't folks know of you? Come away from this show. What the hell are we going to have learned? At least two things to remember.
I would start with a crisis of affordable housing. When we talk about Tucson being an affordable place to live, we tend to think that. Yet nonetheless, the median rent is about $1,000 a month, which could be very hard to do if you're pulling in just $20,000 a year on minimum wage. There's not a lot of growth in that sector. Most of the construction we see going on in terms of large multifamily units are luxury units, maybe on the northwest side, for example. And so what we don't see is we don't see an investment in affordable housing. Rent is going up. It has been going up since the Great Recession, and it keeps going up, where hypothetically, if we were entering into improvement, it should be coming down, and it's not.
But that, I presume, is tied to the fact that without building new homes, people are renting more, or if the Great Recession hangover is keeping wages lower, people can't buy a new home, even if it was available, and so they're renting. That creates a supply-demand thing, or just renters, rentees, whoever rents the house can charge more, and people will pay because they can't afford to buy a new house, so they do their renting.
Yeah, rates of rentals in Tucson went from about 20% pre-recession to today at about 45%. Of all households in Tucson are renting. And that means they're not sort of building up that equity that comes with home buying, and it puts them at really high risk.
So what happens, what's the consequence for actual people? Where are they living if you can't afford rent? You're not sleeping in the park. What are we talking about?
We're talking about a downward slide to find the cheapest possible rental possible. Vacancy rates are very low, so there's a lot of moving to sort of find a cheap, affordable, and I want to say safe and quality housing, right? When you start moving down that spectrum, you start moving away from necessities like air conditioning, safety from crime, and other things. So if we want our kids to go to school every day and get the education that they need, where they're in these dangerous neighborhoods and they can't eat, they can't be in sort of a good environment, they're not going to do well in school.
And that starts the downward spiral.
Yeah.
If you're not doing, if where you're living is difficult, you get less sleep, the noise, crime, other things. You're less attentive at work, et cetera, and then with that you get less paid, and it spirals down. Is the city, as far as you know, since that's the number one problem you identified, targeting some specific programs to try and deal with that?
There are a number of programs to try and deal with that, but sort of, let's say, for example, the list for subsidized housing has been closed for many years now. It's very full. If I were to lose my job and sort of face a bout of poverty, I could not look to the city or the county to immediately house me. That's a very long waiting period. But we are seeing federal opportunity zones created by the IRS. So Pima County applies for them, where there can be development, where developers can be enticed with some financial incentives to start building in places where there's a lot of need and maybe take a bit of a cut on the profits that they could otherwise make on a luxury rental, for example.
Is there federal money available that the state of Arizona's propensity not to take federal money is hurting us on the poverty front?
No, I don't see that being discussed very much
okay.
right now.
All right. Just curious. Robin, from the point of view of what needs to be done to improve education, two things. One thing.
There's a professor at the U of A, and he used to be a school principal, and he did this study, and he found out that kids who live in poverty versus kids who are middle-class families who eat every day and have two parents who speak English, and that they come to school, they arrive in kindergarten, and this number is so shocking that every time I say it, I have to re-look it up. But these children who come out of poverty arrive at school with having only had six books read to them versus a middle-class kid who comes having been read 3,000 books. We are starting our school at a huge deficit for low-income kids. And that is one of the things that good quality childcare is one of the things that actually money, the more you pay, the better it really is. And that's one of the things that would help. That would be a huge help for the kids coming into school.
Fantastic. We're running down here and about ready to head on out. So I want to thank Professor Brian Mayer from the School of Sociology and Robin Hiller, my co-host. This is Al Bergerson.
I just want to say join us at Modern Languages, Backpack Full of Cash, sponsored by your department and mine.
Oh, great movie to go see.
A great movie, and it's free. And it's this Tuesday at 5 p.m.
All right. See you next time. Out.